In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with James Bradley. You may well know him for his book, Flags of Our Fathers, which was the story of the raising of the flag on Iwo Jima in World War II. In fact, his father was one of those men who raised the flag. The book sold very, very well, was very popular, got a lot of attention. He has a new book out now that is also about World War II, and it explores a story that is less well-known, and in fact, until recently, wasn't known at all. It has to do with the fate of 8 American pilots who were shot down in the Pacific, in fact, not all that far from Iwo Jima, where the flag was raised. They were shot down, they were captured by the Japanese, they were tortured, and then they were executed. But the circumstances of their deaths were kept secret. First of all, they were listed as missing and then as killed in action. But their families were never told how they had died because the military and the government decided that the facts were just too disturbing. Only recently has this information become declassified. And we'll talk about how it is that it came to the attention of the author, James Bradley, and about the story in this part of Focus 580. And, of course, if you're interested in reading the story, it is the subject of James Bradley's second book, which is out now fairly recently. The title is Flyboys, A True Story of Courage. It is published by Little Brown and is in bookstores now. Questions are certainly welcome here on the program. We just ask people to be brief so that we can keep the program moving, but anybody's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Bradley, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
Great intro.
We appreciate it. This was, as I said, this information, this had been kept secret. It was classified.
What you just said, yeah, it was fine.
For a long time, and I think that it was in just not until 1996, was it, that it became declassified? 1997. So how is it that it came to your attention? How did you find out about it?
Well, the people think, wow, I really searched out quite a story here. But actually, you know, my dad raised the flag on Iwo Jima, and as you said, the first book I wrote was about the 6 flag raisers. And then one day I was having the exciting life of an author. I was watching some paper print out of my printer, and I picked up the phone, and a guy named Bill out in Iowa said, "Mr. Bradley, I have a startling story." And after just 15 minutes of listening to Bill from Iowa, I said, "Bill, stop. You just ruined my work week. I've got to fly out and look you in the eye to see if this is true." So the next day, I was where everyone wants to be, seated in Iowa in a guy's kitchen that I did not know. On his Formica top kitchen table was a pile of papers, 2 gin and tonics, and a bowl of popcorn. And then Bill began to tell the story. And the story was that Bill, who was 76 as he was telling me the story, back when he was 21 in 1946, he was an observer at a war crimes trial. It was a war crimes trial held in Guam under extreme secrecy to determine the fate of Japanese officers who had beheaded 8 American flyboys on the island of Chichijima, the island right next to Iwo Jima, where my dad helped raise a flag. Now, this was amazing to me because if you think of the Iwo Jima flag raising, it's probably the most illuminated moment in American military history. But Bill in Iowa was trying to tell me that there was a secret held just 150 miles away. At the very moment my dad was helping to raise a flag, American flyboys are being beheaded on the next island, but nobody knew because it was so highly classified. It was buried deep in the files. Most of us didn't even know there was a war crimes trial like this, much less who it involved. 8 guys got their heads cut off. Their mothers and fathers went to their graves, never knowing the fate of their flyboy sons. Then Bill explained something almost equally as startling to me. He said, "There's a 9th guy to the story. There's a 9th flyboy who got away. His name is George Bush. 41, the former president of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush, got shot down there, and he escaped. But he never knew the fate of those 8 other guys until I told him." Now, at the point I'm out there in Iowa hearing the story, I didn't know what to believe, but it's true. I've contacted all the family members of the flyboys and told them the fate of their flyboy brothers for the first time. I looked George Bush in the eye and told him what happened to these eight guys. The former head of the CIA, the former president of the United States, didn't know until I told him. And then he asked me to take him back to the island where he was shot down.
Yeah, that's an amazing angle of the story. As of course, people knew about the fact that he had served in World War II and had been shot down, and fortunately was rescued. But I don't certainly ever remember much of any discussion about what it was his mission was or what he was doing. Just the fact that he was a pilot, he was in the war, he was shot down. And
his mission, like all the flyboys' mission against the island of Chichijima, was to bomb the radio station. There, Marines neutralized Iwo Jima because Iwo Jima was flat. Iwo Jima was strategic because it was flat, so it could be used for airfield. And 80,000 Marines, including my father, took Iwo Jima. Chichijima is mountainous; it's craggy and hilly, like Maui. And Marines did not attack it. We used flyboys to hit the radio stations there. The radio stations were beaming messages from Tokyo out to the Pacific, and they were crucial to destroy. And Bush got shot down trying to bomb it. All these, maybe 25 flyboys, maybe got shot down and died trying to hit these radio stations. Eight of them survived the crash, made it onto land, and then were later killed. Now, you know, at first blush, people can say, oh, yeah, you know, they made it ashore, and then they were killed by the Japanese. But there's a lot more gray to the story. For example, I called James Hall, who lives out in Missouri. He's 80 years old. And I said, Mr. Hall, your brother Floyd was a flyboy who got killed in the Pacific, right? James Hall, 80 years old, said, yes, in 1945, my brother Floyd got killed. And I said, how'd he die? And he said, well, he died on impact. And I said, so the government told you Floyd died on impact? Yes. I said, well, Mr. Hall, actually, your brother spent 2 months on the island of Chichijima as a POW. He was not tied up. He was living with a Japanese major. He was going to Japanese parties. He was learning Japanese jokes. He was using chopsticks. He was teaching the major English. And then one day it was time to die. James Hall never knew that his brother spent 2 months on a Japanese island going to parties, sake parties, until I called him and told him 2 years ago.
Why do you think that it's important for this story to be told now?
I felt this. I felt my dad happened to be in an Iwo Jima photograph by accident, so people imputed that he was a hero. Now, on the very next island, at the same time my dad was raising a flag, eight flyboys are kneeling down for their death sentence. They did not plead for their lives. They did not give up American secrets. They truly gave their life for their countries, and I thought it was time to restore honor to these guys. I mean, we not only did not honor them as heroes, we didn't even know their names. So I felt it was important that the word get out.
Hmm. And I'd certainly want to make sure that we talk in some detail about what happened to these men, because it is the disturbing and the shocking part of the story. That is the way that they were treated by the Japanese, certainly in violation of all principles of war and how prisoners of war are supposed to be treated, even to the point, it's difficult to imagine and not pleasant to talk about, but in fact the Japanese actually ate some parts of these men.
That's true, but that amazing statement we have to put into context. The story of Chichijima is 25,000 Japanese soldiers on the island of Chichijima, more than were on Iwo Jima. There were three brutal top Japanese officers. The top guys who controlled these 25,000 were drunken brutes who beat their own troops, were literally drunk. I've documented it, drunk during the day. You know, often for just 3, 4, 5 days in a row. These guys got it into their alcohol-soaked minds that it would be a lot of fun to abuse their own soldiers by making them chop off flyboys' heads and then, opening up their guts and yanking the liver out. So, you know, we really have it is true that some of these flyboys had their livers eaten, but it's also true that it was work of these three top guys. And America would not know the story unless the average Japanese soldier on Chichijima, disgusted with his officers, came forward and told the Americans a story. We weren't looking for these flyboys on this island. We didn't know if they crashed in the Pacific somewhere or what happened to them. It was the Japanese soldiers who came forth and told the story. That's why we know it.
Mm. And you did go also. You did go to Japan and you talked with some of the Japanese men who were soldiers there. And so you got from them the stories of what it was they saw and what it was they did.
Right. I found Japanese soldiers who were bombed by George Bush, who George Bush was trying to kill. And when he crashed, they were waiting for him to float ashore so they could kill him. I reunited these former combatants who, at the ages of 20 years old, hated each other, and now they're men 78, 79 years old who hug each other with tears in their eyes.
That's something that, for me, I guess, never having had those experiences, that's kind of hard to imagine how those two things can both be true.
Well, the part about 78-year-old men hugging each other, that's the human condition, if you think about it. I mean, that's what we want to be, as friends. The part about them hating each other at 20, that must have been pre-programmed by both countries, because 20-year-olds aren't really able to do that much research on other cultures. My father hit the sands of Iwo Jima on February 19th, 1945, his job was to kill Japanese. He had never seen a Japanese. He did not arrive at his, mission thinking it out himself. But the 78-year-olds, the 80-year-olds, the Iwo Jima veterans who go back to Iwo Jima once a year from Japan and America and embrace each other, and the George Bush who went out and the Japanese soldiers who I got together with President Bush, they've had some time to think things over, and they hug, and they have tears in their eyes. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, James Bradley. He is the author of the best-selling book, Flags of Our Fathers, which is the story of the raising of the flag on Iwo Jima, and also about the lives of those men after that. And one of them was his father. His new book is titled Flyboys, A True Story of Courage. It's published by Little Brown, and it tells the story that here we have been talking about. That is, what happened to these men, American pilots, who were assigned with this mission of taking out this radio transmitting station on the island of Chichijima, which is not all that far from Iwo Jima. They were shot down. A number of them were captured by the Japanese, were brutally treated, and were executed. And the story of what happened to them was classified. It was kept secret. Their families weren't told. No one was told. And it wasn't only until 1996, when it was declassified, that, as James Bradley explained, a man who had been who had been involved in the war crimes trial, who had been sworn to secrecy, said that now that this was declassified, it was time for the story to be told. And that's how it came to James Bradley, and that's how we have this book. And the questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign to talk with on our line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I read the book, and I thought it was wonderful, and there were a few points in the book that I wanted you to maybe elaborate on. First, you talked just a few minutes ago about the condition of the Japanese troops and also of the American troops in terms of their willingness to kill and their attitude. And in your book, you extend this to also exploring the general attitude on each side, on the part of each side, in terms of others, whether it's the Japanese towards the Chinese and the brutality there, and also the fact that the cannibalism wasn't unique to the Pacific, but also it occurred in, if I remember correctly, in China, and that maybe it was exacerbated in the Pacific because of the shortages on the part of rations. So I thought if you could elaborate a little on that. But also, I'm much more interested in your talking about more than just age, but what else made possible reconciliation even earlier on? Even when there were prisoners, there were some with whom they were able to have a relationship of of equals, even given that they were prisoners and the others were their captors. But also what makes possible the reconciliation of such bitter enmity, given what was between the Japanese and the American troops during the war, and how that could be carried over to the world now, whether between, let us say, some of the combatants in the Middle East, or even Iraqis and Americans, or whoever. So I'll let you take off on that.
Well, I took a few notes here. Let me ping off the simpler ones and then focus on the longer one that you're interested in. You mentioned that the willingness to kill and exploring the gentle attitude towards others, others with a capital O. I mean, we always say the rules of war. Were they following the rules of war? Would someone please send me the rules of war? I would love to see them. I've been looking for the rules of war. The rules of war tend to be what, once we demonize an enemy, and by we, I'm not talking about America. I'm talking about any country. Once you demonize the other side, then the rule is to kill them. And then how we kill them is a lot of euphemism and a lot of talking about rules of war. We noticed that when America started a recent war, we said this is our rules regarding prisoners. That was different than what had traditionally been accepted. So we tend to change the rules, not just we Americans, but all combatants do. So if someone could send me the rules of war that people imagine have been going on for 200-300 years or 20-30 years or whatever, I would love to see them. I'd rather take the words of a true warrior like Curtis LeMay, who said this, and I quote, "I'll tell you about war. You kill off enough of the other side, and they stop fighting." Now, that's war. But somehow in America, we have this idea that the prime movement or the prime activity in war is not ruthless killing. It is. That is what war is all about. Cannibalism, not being unique. Look, I consulted an expert on cannibalism in the United Kingdom, and he said, "James, the difference between you and a cannibal is 2 weeks." He said, "The reason you're not a cannibal is because you're near a food supply." So no matter how we want to think about cannibalism and perceive cannibalism and emotionalize about it, the difference between us right now eating the bean sprouts in the refrigerator or deciding who among us who's dead that we're going to eat the legs of is 2 weeks, according to the experts. And then about the issue of reconciliation, and is that something that I can, draw out of the blood of one of these reconciled people and then inject it into future generations? I don't think so. I think that personally I have seen, and I'm not going to generalize because I don't know a lot about European conflicts and I don't know a lot about the Mideast, but I've been interviewing hundreds and hundreds of Pacific veterans in Japan and America, and all I can say is that they went out and they both did their duty. The guys that were trying to kill my father on Iwo Jima, the Japanese guys, and then my father's buddies who were trying to kill the Japanese, they were about the same age. They had about equal amount of knowledge about each other's culture and sensitivity to each other's culture, and they had about equal amount of programming that the other side was just, horrible and that they had to be eliminated for the good of their mutual countries. And then later, when the survivors were able to take a second look at each other's countries, I think they just realized that maybe they were just humans who had some beliefs that didn't come from within. One of the veterans who was on the Bataan Death March, I mean, oh my God, the Bataan Death March, heads chopped here and just a horrible experience, said, and he's in the book, he says, "I have many Japanese friends." He said, "A culture can be programmed. At the turn of the century, the Japanese military captured Japanese society, and it was an island culture. So like a closed biosphere, they just inculcated military values. I mean, they took retired military officers and made them principals of schools and taught the teachers how to beat up the kids, and they were mini boot camps. So the Japanese were completely militarized, and it was an aberration in Japanese culture. Now this man in the book says, you know, you can take any culture and form the minds how you want them to go. Japan is after World War II, righted itself and looked back to its traditional culture, and they're great friends of America now.
Hmm. I want to maybe get back to the caller. Are we getting at your questions?
Yes, thank you.
All right. And others are certainly welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. Again, talking with James Bradley, author of the new book, Flyboys. I think that some people have made the argument, and as you say, that war, first of all, that we would acknowledge that war is about killing. That's what it is. And that all the sides in conflicts do engage in demonizing the other. And some people, I think, would argue that, in fact, you have to do that in order to make it possible for your soldiers to kill the soldiers of the other side. However, I think also people argue, and this is a somewhat controversial argument, and not everyone agrees with it, but some people argue, though, that in the Pacific War, race was a factor to the extent that it was not in the European War, and that it made the behavior of people on both sides more vicious and than it perhaps would have been otherwise. The degree of demonization of the other was more extreme.
Could I comment on
that? Yeah, please.
I'd like to agree and expand that. I can't leave that just all alone.
Right.
Race is a very important fact, but let me go back. Let's go back to Europe. Another aspect about those Nazis, when they clinked champagne glasses and agreed to some Holocaust, they looked great. You know, nice leather boots, good uniforms, they drove Mercedes. We like to see them on the movie screen, even, these villains. So, yeah, we even though they were doing terrible things, champagne glasses, you know, they were European, whatever. We could relate to them a little more. Japanese generals squatting down at little tables on the floor, clicking hot sake, we have a lot more difficulty feeling any identification with that, number one. Number two, World War II in Europe was fought in old ruts. What I mean is that the practices of war, the surrender conventions, the timeouts to get the wounded, holidays, stuff like that. They had fought something called World War I in the same area. So it was as if World War II in Europe, in a way, was fought over familiar ruts. Now you go to a completely strange enemy, and I mean the Japanese were strange to us and we were strange to them. We meet in a completely unexplored strange place called the Pacific. I mean, we didn't even have maps of Guadalcanal and Bougainville when the war started. Completely strange. Not even any big cities out there or even ports out there in the middle of nowhere in the Pacific. And then the West in America, a brand new country that has hardly any Asians here, confronts an island country, Japan, that has hardly any white people in it. So yes, it was race, but it also was the first time. It was a cultural collision. It was tectonic plates grinding against each other for the first time in history out there in the Pacific.
Hmm. I think something that also has to be acknowledged, and you certainly do in your book, is that there was, on the part of the government of the United States, a very deliberate targeting of civilians on the side of Japan. And in fact, more Japanese civilians died in the war than did soldiers.
Yes. The key there that I think some of your World War II listeners would have is targeting civilians. We had our cake and ate it too. We killed a tremendous amount of civilians, saying that we were targeting other things, and that's just what militaries do. We went in, we said, to reduce their industrial capability, but that happened to mean having millions of women with children on their back fleeing from napalm flames.
We did have this very deliberate firebombing campaign. It killed a lot of people, and I do recall, I don't recall here the name of the general, but an American general who actually said, in reference to that, he said, you know, if we had lost this war, I probably would have been tried as a war criminal.
Well, this is the great General Curtis LeMay, who, whatever he was in the 1960s as the Air Force Chief of Staff and as People always say, oh, he was George Wallace's running mate. But long before that, back in 1945, this was America's problem. Germany had surrendered. Japan was beaten but would not surrender. What do you do with an enemy that would not surrender? If you break into my kitchen and you won't surrender even after I cut an arm off, I got to keep going. So I cut your foot off. You're in my kitchen. I can't choose to stop the fight. I have to continue to chop off appendages of yours until you stop. Japan would not stop. They would not surrender, even though they had no navy and their air force hardly existed also. So 38-year-old Curtis LeMay was dispatched to the Pacific. Now, why was a flyboy, why was an airman key? Where is MacArthur? Where is Nimitz? Well, the most expensive instrument of the war, I think your listeners could agree, was the atom bomb. The atom bomb cost $2 billion. But to my surprise, that's wrong. I always believed that was the most expensive weapon of World War II. It was actually the B-29. The delivery system cost $3 billion. And that $3 billion was a heavy weight back in Washington. That was a lot of pennies from grandmas. And the B-29 was not ending the war with Japan. You had an island nation. You had water. We couldn't invade it like we could Normandy and run to Berlin. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, we could invade it. We could do it later. But you got an island nation with a lot of water. So the B-29, this huge investment. Well, the B-29's not working. They send Curtis LeMay out there, who realizes that if they continue to do high-altitude strategic bombing and tell Americans that we're sending bombs down smokestacks, this war is going to go on forever, and maybe a million people will die. So Curtis LeMay says, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to strip out all the guns of the plane, take out all the extra weight, stuff the bellies with napalm, jellied gasoline developed by Harvard, jellied gasoline, and run it over the heads of the civilians of Tokyo and all these other cities and just keep burning the country down until they stop. I mean, if my neighbors are shooting at me right here and I have the ability to burn their house down until they stop, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And Curtis LeMay looked at war as you kill enough of the other side and they stop fighting. So he went out there. People talk about the Battle of Iwo Jima. It was a terrible battle. 22,000 Japanese dead. 22,000 dead Japanese soldiers. We napalmed about 500,000 civilians to death. Then they stopped. Americans think the history of the Pacific is Pearl Harbor, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, then it's all over. No. The atom bombs, they played a part, but we killed many, many, many more Japanese with napalm, jelly gasoline, than we did with atomic energy.
How now do we balance out these two things? On the one hand, people looking at the dropping of the nuclear weapons or the firebombing campaigns and saying that, on the one hand, saying that these were war crimes. We balance that with people on the other hand who would say, and I'm sure that you heard the same things from many veterans, who would say, look, it was us or them. This was the evil empire. We were fighting for the side of right. We weren't the aggressors. They were. And I'm sure you hear from a lot of people who said, look, I lost a lot of friends in this war. And by adopting this strategy, yeah, people were killed, but I survived. Other friends of mine survived, on balance, what we did was right because right was on our side.
Well, that's the traditional argument that any country always, in every century, and in the future, centuries from now, will always make. That's what you want the young combatants of any country to come to that conclusion, whether you're from India or Ceylon or Malaysia or America or Peru, you want your young combatants to say right was on our side. That gets them going, and you know, so that's a common argument. I'm not talking about an American sense. I think what I would do in terms of moral judgments is this. I'd get the mother who had her parents napalmed to death in a room, get in with a B-29 bomber who dropped that napalm, then get my dad in the room who was on Iwo Jima, and then get Mike Strank in the room who raised the flag on Iwo Jima, and then get Mr. Hayashi who cut off Jimmy Dai's head on Chichijima, and then get Jimmy Dai here, and then I'd say to them, do you all agree that war is a crime? And I think all those people who experienced that would shake their head yes in that room. So in terms of talking about war crimes and trying to point fingers, Bill Connell, who was captured on Chichijima, Bill Connell is a flyboy who was on Chichijima. He was held for 7 days, tied up in a tree. I took him back to Chichijima with President Bush. He said to me, now this is not my opinion, this is a veteran who was a POW, said, war is a crime that the older generation perpetuates on the young. So, you know, war crimes, the point of a war is to kill. So, Sir Arthur Davis, I think, who ran the air bombing campaign for Churchill over Germany, and this quote is in the book, he said, name a part of war that is not a crime. He said, sticking a bayonet in a man's belly, that's better than an atomic bomb, that's not a crime. War is a crime.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, James Bradley, and we're talking about his new book, Flyboys, that does lay out this story that we've been talking about here, a story of the war in the Pacific, and specifically about the experiences of these men who were shot down as they staged bombing raids against this island in the Pacific, Chichijima, that had an important radio installation there, a Japanese installation that the Allies wanted to take out, that was very well defended. And so the men who went against it, a number of them were shot down. Some of them were captured, were tortured, and killed by the Japanese. One who was shot down and got away was indeed George Bush, the elder George Bush, the father of the current president. And the stories were kept secret until 1996. It was classified. Even the families of these men were not told because the government decided it was just too disturbing and it would be better that they not know. He's also author, by the way, of the book Flags of Our Fathers. It was a big bestseller about the men who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. One of them was his dad, Little Brown, the publisher of the book Flyboys. We have some callers here. Let's go next to Belgium, over by Danville, and line number four. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably very important to notice that everybody who fights the war is young. They don't want old soldiers, they want young soldiers. And it's also very important to notice that George Jr. wraps his war today in patriotism. And patriotism seems to be the thing that sells a war to anybody, no matter what side you're on. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Well, you want to comment on that at all, Mr. Bradley?
You know, patriotism is a word that on my book tours and letters that I receive, I see the word patriotism an awful lot from people writing now and talking now to me. I interviewed hundreds and hundreds of veterans for these two books out in the Pacific. I never had a veteran of the Pacific talk to me about the word patriotism when they were out there. It's just funny. It's a total lie. Patriotism is like a euphemism that I hear people describe the past now. But the guys who walked onto the beach at Iwo Jima, I never had a guy say, you know, my patriotic heart was beating and so I turned left. And
yeah?
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I was afraid just for the moment there we lost our connection.
No.
Well, okay, let's go on to another caller here, Chicago, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm a little late to the show, so I don't know. I know that this happened to George Bush's crew. One of the questions I was going to ask you, why did they keep it classified? And another one was, didn't the same thing happen to a group of Marines when Carlson's raider invaded Macon Island, and they accidentally left eight or nine Marines behind when they left, and they were taken to Kwajalein and beheaded?
There's two questions there. Nothing was kept secret about George Bush's mission and his crew. That's been detailed in other books. What isn't detailed is what would have happened to George, what was happening to the island, on the island to the other George Bushes, the George Bushes that didn't get away.
Well, he was
what
the
happened
only one
to them on that island? That was classified, and the reason it was classified is simply this. Now it's a little strange to understand, but there was no government policy. There was no policy. We need to classify this for this reason. The reason it was classified is just human nature. Young American males in 1946 saw that these guys had had their heads cut off, their bodies desecrated, and said, "I'm not telling Mom." Now, 2 years ago, a Navy SEAL fell out of a helicopter in Afghanistan. We had a drone up above taking beautiful digital imagery of him being castrated.
Oh, boy.
You didn't see that on the news, and the mother never saw that tape. It was just, you know, deep sixth.
Well,
now, I think you had another question in there.
Wasn't there? Didn't the same thing happen to some Marines on?
Oh, the Macon. Macon deal.
Yeah.
Well,
some were captured and later beheaded by the Japanese.
Right. Well, we knew. I mean, that was just a mystery, like exactly what happened to them and where are their bodies. And then they found their bodies. But in this case, we didn't even know where to look. We didn't know these flyboys had been taken prisoner on Chichijima.
Wasn't that commander later executed?
Excuse me?
Wasn't the commander of those forces later executed?
Of what
the,
force?
The commander of the Japanese.
Of the Japanese.
Chichijima.
Yes.
We held a war crimes trial, and seven officers, including the three nasty commanders, were hung and buried in unmarked graves on Guam.
Yeah, the trouble is that there's a two-front war, but in the Pacific, you know, racism and war are deadly individually, but together that's a lethal combination. And I think
definitely. The killing was particularly nasty out in the Pacific. I'd like to go back to the war crimes trial, you know, discussion. Just to be clear, would I have signed up for a napalm mission? Let's go. You got to stop this war. I'm not criticizing, the napalming of Japan as a war crime. What I am wondering about, though, is if you look at Curtis LeMay's biography on the U.S. Air Force website, or if you look at the founding of the United States Air Force, one of the seminal moments, one of the most important moments in the history of the Air Force is the burning down of Japan. You can't find much detail about that. How come?
Well, they didn't do that to Germany, though, did they? I mean, they didn't only to Dresden. I mean, they firebombed Dresden, but...
It's all detailed in the book, 45,000 in Dresden, sir, 100,000 in Tokyo.
Yeah, you know.
It's all detailed, but I'm just saying that I'm not the one who, you know, I'm just trying to bring this out and say these are the facts of war. We tend to euphemize and only look at the other side's tough decisions in war, and then ours somehow don't make it onto our American websites.
Well, that's true. There's a number of things going on about various wars. They think that the American army might have massacred some Korean civilians during the early days of that war, so these things tend to come out sooner or later.
I mean, war is, you know, I don't know if it's a massacre or if it's a slaughter or if it's a rules of war. There's all these words, but Americans have to realize that the word WAR, when you use the military, it is about ending the life of the other side. It's not about a lot of other euphemisms. I mean, Curtis LeMay, and this is not me talking, Curtis LeMay, who killed more Japanese than anybody else, said, "I'll tell you what war is about. You kill enough of the other side and they stop fighting." Paul Tibbetts, who dropped the atomic bomb, said, "There is no morality in warfare. You kill children, you kill old men, women." He said, "You don't mean to do it, but there's no morality in warfare." To me, this is... Now, someone in Kansas City, I gave a speech, and he said, "Mr. Bradley, I'm troubled that you're saying that, you know, we lost our morality." I said, "I didn't say that. I said, war is like a typhoon. So you could be an orderly person. You have an orderly desk. You look orderly in terms of your belt is buckled. But you go into a typhoon, there's only disorder. You cannot maintain your personal order in a typhoon. So you can be a moral person, but when you go into the typhoon of war... The experts in flyboys tell us that in that typhoon, there is no morality."
Well, there never has been in any of the wars that we fought from the revolution to the present time. There never has been. I don't know if there's been a moral war. I don't think there's ever been one where people didn't do things that were, you know, unnatural. You look at Quantrill's raid on Lawrence, Kansas, for instance, but I'm digressing.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for the call. Let's let us go to another caller here. This would be Champaign County and line two. Hello.
Hi. Well, I don't buy it at all. I think that you can argue that your...
Can you say what you don't buy, sir? I just
that war is a typhoon. War is a project of human beings, and they have to be judged on it. And we had our war trials, so obviously we didn't let them make the typhoon defense. you know, at Nuremberg or in Tokyo at the War Crimes Tribunal. So obviously we were holding others to a standard. The thing about it is the firebombing of Tokyo happened, you know, after there was already a clear assurance that the U.S. was going to let the emperor stay and was backing off from the unconditional surrender argument that was still extant before the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But it was clear that, as you say, there was no army. The Navy was wiped out. It was you don't keep torturing the victim, it seems to me, at that point. Obviously, I'm not apologizing for the victimization that the Japanese did anywhere in the Pacific front or in China or Mongolia, but this whole idea that you can, I'm aghast at the way you're presenting this. It seems to me.
I know, sir, because we have a fundamental. We're looking at different time zones. That's the problem.
I think this is as true now as it was then, and it's true now as then as it was during the Peloponnesian Wars. Go ahead.
But could I just make this?
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. You said, you know, about war crimes trials, judging, you know, whatever. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the beaches of Iwo Jima.
No, you were talking about the firebombing of Tokyo, so go ahead.
Yeah, but I'm talking in the typhoon, sir. I'm not talking about in the courtroom thinking about the typhoon.
Well, you can't make a typhoon defense. I mean,
I'm not, but I never made a typhoon defense. You went
into
a
courtroom. You can't just say I'm following orders. That was that's the history of Nuremberg, but you're saying...
Oh, no, sir. I never... Okay, you brought up a number of facts about the extant thing about the emperor that I totally disagree with. We're not agreeing on any facts. All I'm saying is the thing my dad went into was a typhoon. My dad cried in his sleep for the first 4 years he was married. I've interviewed guys who are in their 80s who say to me, James, I can't talk to you because I'm on Prozac. I'm not talking about the lawyers and the philosophers and the guys like you and me who haven't been in it. I'm talking about my dad's friends who are having difficulty sleeping right now, sir. That's
well, my
all.
Father was in Okinawa right after the slaughter, so
that's fine. But I there's so many facts that you've said that I've documented in a different way in my book. I either have to say my book is wrong, or I have to challenge your facts. And I don't know if we have time to do this.
I don't think we do. One thing I heard you in St. Louis on a tape show, so I couldn't interact with you. But you said that George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, checked, and I don't. You didn't give any documentation. I know that there's another pilot or wing man in that sortie that absolutely disagrees with your facts. That he thought that Bush bailed out immediately. You said that he checked and saw that there was no way to save anyone. But there is definitely.
Well, once again, you did say you. You are mixing fact and fiction there, and there is a little truth to what you say, but there's some fiction. I didn't say what you said. I said, if you'd like to know the facts about the George Bush situation and the guy in California who's objected to the way George Bush has told the story, I'd be happy to document it for you. But
well, go back and listen to the tape from St. Louis. You said that he checked and there was nothing, and you didn't acknowledge that there were people contesting his role even.
Well, that's very widely known, and I'm sorry.
We just got a couple minutes left, and again, I hope the caller will forgive me because I got one more caller I'd like to try and get in. This listener is in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes. Well, I think that you know your thesis of trying to morally deal with our past wars, particularly ones that were considered necessary to defend freedom. And
but what's my moral thesis?
Evil.
Because I didn't know I stated one. But
Let me finish. I think that you know that's virtuous, but I think that the conditions have changed because I think the moral consciousness in our country has changed. And so I would point out that the fact that human rights advocates and the media are now merging their efforts to make our war efforts more just and more justifiable is a great advancement, and that's really all I would want to say.
I couldn't, I could hardly even comment on it because I'm stuck back in 1945, really.
Well, we're not.
I know,
so
but I wasn't trying to talk about today, sir. I was just talking about Curtis LeMay, Paul Tibbetts, these guys back then in that Pacific War. But I appreciate your bringing it up to date.
Well, that's I guess that is the impulse to want to say what this story, looking back at that war and those experiences, what does that give us any sort of guidance? Does it help us all in how we think about war today?
People are asking me to summarize after two books on the Pacific War with a lot of mayhem. I don't know if I can come up with any neat packages. So what I've done is I've started a peace foundation that's on my website, jamesbradley.com. And it's a peace foundation that sends American high school kids to school in Japan. And the concept is if you take this mushhead school kid and go bake him in a Japanese mother's living room for 1 year, they'll come back and rise in society and government, and the next time that we're confronted with some difficult choices regarding an enemy that doesn't look like us, these kids might be there to lend a certain opinion. So I know that's naive, but I'm giving it a chance. We're sending a number of kids every year to school over in Japan.
One thing maybe we can touch on real quick that we hadn't is that I'm interested. You had the opportunity to talk with some people. Now, I believe for the parents of all of the guys that you talk about in the book are all gone, but there are some people left who knew them, who did have connections to them. What was the reaction of people? Because you did get a chance to talk with some people and say, look, this is something you never knew, but this is what happened to this person. What sort of reaction did you get from people?
Shock. You know, I wondered what it would be like to call the brothers and sisters and tell them how their brother died and having them know it for the first time. They some took it quietly, many different ways, but after a period of 2 years, now that the word is out and I've intermingled with these family members many times, the word coming back is healing. There's a sense of healing. These family members never really knew what happened to their brothers. They never had a body to grieve over. They never had any facts to really massage in their grief. And as a result of these facts that have come out, these family members now can talk about their fallen flyboy brothers and their healing.
We'll have to stop there. We've used our time. Mr. Bradley, I want to say thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for having me again. I'll get back to work and write a third book so I can make another appearance.
All right. James Bradley is our guest. The book that we've been talking about is titled Flyboys, A True Story of Courage, and is published by Little Brown.